Welcome to Across the Dietary Universe, a podcast where we bring experts along our voyage to discover the secrets of food and how it relates to each of our unique dietary profiles. From the origins of diets to current eating trends to the frontier of food innovation and the future of how we eat, we'll discover that when it comes to food, things are not necessarily as they seem. Honeycomb is a mobile app that works with your iPhone or Android device to help you find suitable food to eat at restaurants near you based on your specific dietary requirements. If you're plant-based and celiac, low FODMAP with a tree nut allergy, keto and dairy-free, we support countless dietary combinations and profiles. Based on your inputs, Honeycomb curates the best restaurants for you and the best options to order at those restaurants. If you have more severe allergies, don't worry. Honeycomb only recommends you places that have a clear protocol to deal with cross-contamination. Pre-order Honeycomb today at get.honeycomb.ai. First of all, Jenny, thank you so much for coming on the Across the Dietary Universe podcast. Obviously, this is a podcast by my company, Honeycomb AI, where we have a similar mission in helping people with dietary needs find food they can eat and just helping them live a good life. And I know you have a lot to talk about that. So let me just do our quick little intro here for you. Jenny Levine Fink is a certified holistic nutrition coach, recipe creator, and the founder of Good For You Gluten Free. Jenny specializes in helping people manage celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. She's the author of Dear Gluten, It's Not Me, It's You, a guide to surviving without gluten and restoring your health in the aftermath of a celiac or gluten sensitivity diagnosis. But even that description doesn't encompass the entire gamut of the things that Jenny does. So she does so much. If you go on her website, if you check it out, there's so many things that she does for the community. And we're just very excited to talk to Jenny today. So Jenny, thanks so much for being here and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Congrats on the podcast and excited to be here.
Thank you so much. So I'm sort of curious to know, like, is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Because there's all these remedies and there's all these solutions and there's all these sort of ways and strategies to, you know, if you're celiac or gluten sensitive, is there going to be a light at the end of the tunnel where it's just going to be a breeze, or are we in this for the long run? I'd love to know that process, starting with the hard question here.
The magic question. Well, you know, I think that, you know, I really do love what I do, and I like to tell people I made my mess my mission, and really this was the mess that I was going through transitioning to the gluten-free diet after a celiac diagnosis. So, you know, I don't know if there's light at the end of the tunnel in terms of gluten sensitivity and celiac disease going away. I think it's a disorder that is here to stay, and I would love to see a cure or a vaccine. There's all sorts of treatment options on the horizon, but nothing that's really sticking. But I do think in terms of managing this disorder, which both a gluten sensitivity and a celiac disease diagnosis must be managed 100% with food, a gluten-free diet, a very strict gluten-free diet, I do think we're getting better as a society, if that answers your question. Uh-huh. I mean, there are more options. I mean, we even have things like gluten-free Oreos all of a sudden, you know, our junk food has gone gluten-free, which is great in many ways too. And restaurants are coming around to it. I know many restaurants were really, really resistant to hop on what they thought was this gluten-free bandwagon or gluten-free trend. Uh-huh. And now you're seeing them more and more take it seriously, expand their options, and really realize that this is a new way of eating for millions and millions of people, and it's growing.
Got it. I would agree with that. And it is nice to see restaurants starting to be a little bit more friendly towards this. I mean, when I started my company, it was a few years back, and it was definitely a bit of a different climate. I think things are changing for the better. But still, there are situations, you know, I talk to a lot of restaurants all the time and servers. There's still a bit of a taboo when a customer orders something and, you know, they ask for modifications. And then it's like, oh, one of those. And you know, yes, if you go to LA, if you go to Portland, if you go to, or even here in Vancouver, you know, you're going to get a lot of these more progressive restaurants that they're not going to, you know, there is no taboo for them. I guess the question that I ask experts sometimes is this a social cultural sort of issue that we're seeing as well, beyond just a physical medical issue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that restaurants are just insanely busy. They're not built to handle food allergens. If you go into any Italian or pizza restaurant, there's flour everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of restaurants are in some ways worried that they can't accommodate a strict gluten-free diet or some sort of allergen diet. And so they don't want to get sued. They don't want to have that legal responsibility. And that's where you're seeing these restaurants try to accommodate the gluten-free market. You know, they are offering, my favorite is gluten conscious menu. Like, okay, what is that? What are you talking about? You know, but gluten sensitive or gluten-free friendly with that asterisk saying they can't guarantee it, because I really do think they can't. That said, more and more, you're seeing restaurants come up with clever ways to actually accommodate this allergy crowd, because we're not going away. Mm-hmm. And more likely than not, when I go out to dinner, let's say I go out to dinner with eight people, couples, friends, family, I'm pretty much the one picking the restaurant for eight people. I'm deciding where eight people are going to spend their money that night, because nobody wants to go to a restaurant where I can't eat. That's no fun to watch, you know, watch them all eat. And they'd feel really uncomfortable if I was just drinking water and watching them eat.
Yeah.
And so I think restaurants are more and more working to accommodate, maybe retrofitting their kitchens with space that would handle no gluten or no allergens or things like that. And so you're seeing some of these restaurants come along. Like here in the US, we have California Pizza Kitchen, and they do have this special area where they just make certain gluten-free pizzas.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they have a certification from the gluten-free certifying organization from the GIG. And so that you see restaurants testing the waters in these trends. And I think at some point it is about money. And if they can, you know, if this is going to help them survive and help them thrive, they will continue to feed this market. But if not, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe there won't be as many options if they can't make a business case for it.
Yeah, fair enough. And I think sort of sometimes one diet will lead to accommodation of another diet. Like I find with plant-based restaurants, a lot of plant-based restaurants are quite forward and quite progressive. And because they're already accommodating, they become a beacon in the community for people with all sorts of dietary needs. We don't always think about it, but let's say you had like a severe dairy allergy, for example, where you can go to a vegan restaurant. You don't have necessarily, you know, before vegan restaurants, you might have to go to You might just have to guess and call and, you know, talk to a travel agent or something like that. But now that sort of seeing this, and a lot of plant-based restaurants here in Vancouver are also celiac friendly as well. So it's a very interesting phenomenon I see there. My gut feeling is that eventually restaurants will more and more realize that this is something that affects a huge portion of the population, and it will become like a standard service to, you know, for ingredient disclosure and preparation disclosure and things like that. I don't want to spend all of our time today talking about restaurants. I want to get into the story now. I want to know a little bit more about Jenny. I want to know more about how it began and how did you discover you even had celiac disease? I know people probably ask you this all the time, but I'd love to hear it here.
I do get asked a lot, but I, you know, when you are in this community, you love to share your story and you love to hear other people's stories. So I never can get enough of hearing how other people were diagnosed and how that happened. But for me, I was in my mid 30s at the time, and I was just experiencing severe bloating and gas. And it's kind of embarrassing, you know, as a young woman to be like, okay, I'm so gassy, like, don't come near me kind of feeling. And this really painful bloating where, you know, I could wear skinny jeans at the start of the day, but then had to unbutton my pants at the end of the day. But I didn't think much of it. It kind of was always part of me. I was always sort of bloated after eating, and I thought that was normal. Then I went to my doctor just for my annual exam, like no big deal exam. And I just asked her if there was something that helped with the bloating. Like, was there a medication, a pill, something that I could take that would help with this extreme bloating and gas that I was feeling? And she was really actually wise at the time, because 10 years ago, celiac disease wasn't a really as common as it is today. And she said, this didn't sound normal. And she just wanted to run some tests on me. I was so naive back then, such a brain fog about nutrition and food and medicine, just blindly trusted my doctor. Okay, run some tests on me. Yeah. Didn't even ask her, well, what tests are you running on me? You know, so she just ran some blood tests, and not even a week later gave me that call and said, you know, you have celiac. And, you know, not wow. really, I kind of knew what it was, not really at the time, because when you're not in it, you don't really understand it or take the time to learn about it. But I did have one friend that was gluten-free. She didn't have celiac, but I kind of, you know, had talked to her about it. So I knew a little bit about celiac. And so that's how I was diagnosed. And I was literally in the middle of eating a Subway six-inch sandwich. And I was like, should I stop eating gluten, like, right now? She's like, yeah, I think you should. So I like had this sandwich in my hand and probably the most disgusting awful food that I could have been eating while I'm getting diagnosed with a disorder not to eat that.
Oh, my God. Yeah, and we don't even know how much of that's bread. That's another issue. So that's fairly quick, because some people have a super long journey of not knowing what's going on. So thankfully you had a doctor that kind of understood what tests to run immediately.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for that. I think most people, I think the average is 4 to 11 years to get a diagnosis of suffering before they get a diagnosis.
I thought you were going to say months, but that's scary.
Years.
Wow. What was your reaction after the Subway? Because you probably realized you can't eat a lot of food anymore. Did you have nightmares? Oh, no more pasta, no more pizza. No. What was going through your head?
Well, I learned how much I loved bread and pasta and pizza and how, you know, addicted I was to that stuff. It was really hard to give up. So that was I like to call it maybe a period of mourning in my life. Mm. It was definitely in this brain fog. I was definitely having this physical reaction to not eating gluten, you know, and Dr. William Davis, he's the author of the book Wheat Belly. It's a New York Times bestseller for like a decade.
Yeah.
You know, he talks a lot about how wheat is this opiate, you know, gives this opiate like addiction to people. So I definitely had those physical withdrawals, but at the same time, I was definitely really sad, and I had to mourn that process. You know, no more pizza, mm-hmm. you know, no more mac and cheese, no more of these things that we come to take for granted and we just eat mindlessly in many ways. Yeah. And that's really what, you know, after I kind of got through that initial grieving process of breaking up with gluten, and that's kind of why I named my book the way I named it, is because it really was this grieving process, this breakup process, kind of a messy divorce in a way from gluten. That's when I started to really look into nutrition and understand, like, how was that Subway sandwich beyond the bread affecting my body, and really taking the time to study it in earnest and figuring out what I needed to do to heal my body beyond just taking out that, you know, nasty gluten protein, right? So,
yeah. And how long did it take you to get comfortable? Because, you know, how long was that mourning period until you woke up and said, it's a new day, it's a new dawn?
Well, sometimes I still mourn gluten, especially when I eat at restaurants and I see how easy it is for everyone to place their order and trust the food. And, you know, I sort of look at my food with an evil eye, like, is this really gluten-free? Are you sure? You know, things like that, you know. So I still mourn that period, but I'd say it took, to be honest, it took a couple of years for me to fully feel good, feel well in my body physically. And I had a lot of healing to do. It wasn't an instant feeling great. It was a process of restoring my body after it was broken, in a sense. Yeah. And then, you know, emotional, I still have that heavy emotional burden. Like, sometimes I could cry thinking about it, but I call it, you know, the emotional burden of the gluten-free diet, and all of us bear it because it does affect our lives in so many ways, our social lives, our friends, our family. And, you know, it is a loss. I know it's kind of silly to think about food and pizza as a loss, but it is a loss. It's a loss of a little bit of freedom too, of traveling and eating out. It's hard when you're social and you like to eat out. Like, I like to do those things, but it's definitely changed me in many ways.
Did you feel it more in terms of going out or also at home? Because I know, like, cereal's out of the question, you know, whatever. Right. Well, did you feel it at home more, or was it mostly going out?
You know, it was you feel it everywhere, and especially if you don't have a safe home, which means if you don't have a home that's gluten-free, no place is sacred. Maybe you find a gluten-free restaurant. And so I actually give my husband a lot of credit for this. It'd been a couple years of eating gluten-free, just me, nobody else in my family. So we still had all the gluten in the house, the crackers, the cookies. You know, I had little kids at the time.
And
my husband said, you know, it's really unfair that there isn't like one place you can go to that you feel safe, that you know those crumbs on the counter are not gluten, they're not going to make you sick. And I was struggling with my health in the years following my celiac diagnosis. So he said, you know, I don't care what it costs. I don't care what it takes. Let's just make our house gluten-free. Like there's no sense in having gluten in the house. The kids want gluten at school. They can go buy something. They can go out with their friends. You know, they can order at a restaurant if they want to have a non-gluten-free meal, but at home, everything's gluten-free. And we've really kept our house gluten-free for a really long time. I mean, well over 5 or 6 years now. And I have one place in this world that I feel completely safe touching any countertop, touching any sponge or touching anything in my house. It's all okay for me. And I thought that was a really beautiful way that my husband kind of showed me that respect and love. So
I have all these butterflies now. Love. that is really a big move, and good for him for doing that, to give you that safe space. You do deserve to have a safe space, most definitely. They are few and far between in the external world. Talking to other nutrition experts, holistic nutritionists, you know, they emphasize stress and the impact stress has on your body as well. You know, the thing that I learned about celiac, and when I started my company, I didn't know too much, to be honest. I started it for myself, and then, you know, talking to people at the Canadian Celiac Association and meeting with them. They're saying, well, you know, we actually don't necessarily feel our symptoms right away if we have them. There could be damage that's done and we don't even know, which is why there's sort of sometimes misunderstanding within the celiac community, because some people think they can go and you know, just order a gluten-free pizza at a place that has cross-contamination. And they're like, well, I don't feel anything, so it should be fine. Meanwhile, they're getting hurt inside. And then others will have, you know, will feel the impact of getting glutened very quickly. And so I thought that was always a little bit, I thought that was very intriguing, actually, because for me, I feel things immediately. If I eat some dairy, if I'm, you know, whatever, I feel it right away. And that's dangerous, where you can actually get hurt and not even know.
Right.
And so I guess the question that I have is, does stress, I'm butchering this word, I can't pronounce some words, exacerbate the stress, exacerbate the impact of getting glutened?
Right. I mean, it's a great question. And like, just even with your point about there's a large percentage of people who have what's called silent celiac or asymptomatic celiac. They don't have symptoms. They don't feel it, or they're not feeling those classical GI kind of symptoms that many of us face. But stress definitely plays a role in our whole body health. And I think any expert would say that. And I think just in common sense, any layman person would say that. Mm-hmm. And stress really can prevent that healing, because I think a lot of us don't realize that we sort of hold that stress in our stomachs, in our belly, you know, like that can make us physically sick. Stress can make us physically sick. It really can. And it definitely isn't going to help you heal when you already have a stressed out stomach or, you know, it's a small intestine or whole digestive system is broken. Stress is definitely going to exacerbate that. And so that's actually one of the, you know, healing methods they talk about in the book that really helped me to heal my body, you know, and realizing that my small intestine is broken just because I can't see it. Like I could see my leg is broken if I broke my leg, and I'd have to wear a cast and I'd have to stay off my leg for a week, you know, running, no more skiing, all that stuff. But if my digestive system is broken, I can't not eat, right? I have to eat.
Right.
So ways to really help it heal, you know, stress is definitely one thing that you need to mind, especially if you live a very stressful life.
Yeah, and so people need to be on the lookout for, you know, if you have celiac disease, you need to be even more careful with regard to the other elements that are going on holistically in your body. This honestly, like, I'm really, you know, I'm kind of disappointed that people that were like, I guess the mainstream medical sphere has not emphasized, you know, teaming up with a holistic nutrition expert. Because I, you know, the three things for me always are what you eat, how you sleep, and how you move, to, for, you know, in terms of exercise and rest and all of those. And then what you eat, this sort of will help to create a, you know, a good balanced climate in your body. Except you don't really get that. You know, when I go to my GI, it's very much you're on your own. I'm going to make sure you're not severely sick right now, and I'll advise on any medication. But beyond that, it's a crapshoot basically for what's going to help you be okay. They might say, well, some people find not eating dairy helps them. But in regards to almost anything else, there's not too many studies to do that. So I think it's important for anyone probably with any type of condition to reach out to, you know, a holistic nutrition expert just to get that advice from a different perspective. And I guess another question there would be, do you work with people that have other conditions and diseases besides celiac? Or are you specifically celiac oriented?
Yeah, I specifically, target with my content and things that I put out for people in the gluten-free community. For whatever medically necessary reason they are gluten-free, that is, you know, the kind of content that I'm dishing out. I don't do a lot of one-on-one consulting anymore. I've really found that my voice can be amplified to more people through my blog and through my book and things like that. So I've been really concentrating on less of the one-on-one and more of the one-to-many, I guess, kind of consulting. But, you know, I'd love to comment a little bit more on even what you were saying about doctors, because I did pull this stat that US, I don't know what it's like in Canada, but US medical schools offer an average of 19.6 hours of nutrition education to their four-year medical students. So that's not very much nutrition education that we're seeing in medical schools, and we're hopeful that that will change.
Right.
But I think one thing that is difficult with doctors is that they're trained to diagnose and prescribe, and you walk into your doctor's office, you get a few minutes with them, you know, and at that time, you just want to be fixed. You know, my finger's falling off, fix it, right?
Yeah.
And some of these chronic issues that so many of us have can't be fixed with a few stitches or a pill or whatever, right? It's actually a lot of patient-driven education, is that we have to put in the hard work. And I know, and potentially you might notice, that I wasn't really paying attention to what I was eating. I was eating whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I got this reset, this, you know, wait a second, you're sick. You got to pay attention to what you're eating. And then I had to actually advocate for myself. I had to read labels. I had to really change my diet for the better. And that was hard. That was way harder than popping a pill or cutting something out of me, changing my whole lifestyle, turning my world upside down. And so I think that if we can get more education out there and people actually realize food is medicine, what you put in your body affects every cell in your body. When we actually start to realize that, and we start to appreciate that, and treat our bodies a little bit better as a whole and as a society, we'll need less medical intervention. We'll have less disease in our world. And I think that's where the issue can be. And, you know, I blame doctors. I don't blame doctors, because I know that we go to our doctor, we just want to be fixed. We want the easy route. We want the easy button, right?
So. And do you think it's like, because some people will label it as, oh, it's nefarious and they're doing this for a reason and blah, blah, blah. But I know, like, I like two investors in my company are physicians, and one of my best friends is a physician. And I've seen the med school process and everything like that. And it's obviously not with any ill intention. It's, of course, with the intention to heal as many people as possible. But it does seem like it's not preventative almost by any means. It's mostly just reactive medicine, in the sense that, well, when your finger's broken, come see me. Not necessarily how to not break your finger, for example. And obviously that's a weird example, but, but so in your opinion, is this something that is just evolving, and we're not quite there yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us know that we are on the cusp of having diseases. We're pre-diabetic, we're not diabetic. We're osteopenia, we're not osteoporosis yet. Yeah. And a lot of these diseases that we get, you know, pre-diagnosed with, or we realize we have elevated blood pressure, all these things, it does require a change in diet. It might require you to eat less meat. It might require you to give up gluten and sugar. And these are hard things. And I think as people, we're just wired to crave these kind of foods. And if you, you know, watch any sort of television program, you know, you're going to see commercials for all these foods that you're going to crave. And then, you know, there's food scientists working at companies like Right. McDonald's to make their food more and more craveable. So I don't know where the responsibility for this ends. Is it us? Is it individuals? Yeah, there's individual responsibility. Is it these corporations? Yeah, there's responsibility. Mm. And is it, you know, government? Is it doctors? Yeah, I think we all bear some responsibility in this. It's not just your fault for being sick. There's a lot that goes into making us sick as a society, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I stopped drinking like even soda pop maybe like 10 years ago. Which is hard to do because I grew up on it, like drinking it, you know, fairly often, and it's delicious and it's great. Right. And sugar is just something that, you know, I was speaking to a lot of nutrition experts about sugar, and a lot of people who end up having any sort of autoimmune condition will just cut sugar out. They're like, this is not the vibe. This is not what we're looking for. There's not really too many benefits to that. What's your opinion on sugar and how that, and does that impact the, does that impact, you know, people with celiac, for example?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, my opinion on sugar is it is delicious, right? Yeah, and exactly. It's gluten-free. Yeah. Is it good for you? No. Uh-huh. Can you avoid it? No. It's part of our diets. And I think it's recognizing that, you know, sugar is here and it's okay to have sugar. It's okay to eat a treat. You should never feel deprived because that's going to do more harm than good. But I think when we can start to realize the sugar, the role sugar plays in our gut health, especially if we are sick. And so I'll give you an example. So those first 2 years of my diagnosis, like I said, my digestive system was broken, for lack of a better word here. And I still experienced that persistent bloating and gas that really plagued me. And I'm like, why am I gluten-free? Like, it's not working, right? Yeah. And that's when I had to really look at my gut health and look at figuring out what else might be at play. And I did, I ate a lot of sugar. I ate a lot of refined carbs. And so I did not get a diagnosis, but I sort of self-diagnosed myself after researching with Candida and realizing that I just had a lot of bacteria and yeast in my belly that needed to be cleared out. And what feeds yeast? If you bake, you know, it's sugar. Sugar feeds the yeast. It's like when you make bread, you put your yeast with your water and then you just put a little sugar in it. And that's what makes the yeast bubble up and come alive. And that's how you can test if your yeast is alive. And so every time you put sugar in your body, if you have, you know, some sort of yeast or bacteria buildup in your stomach, or you have more bad bacteria, they're going to just be so happy feeding on that bacteria. They're going to be lighting up and you're going to be feeling all bloated and nasty.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, after realizing that I needed to maybe fix my gut health, I actually cut out sugar for an entire month. It was really hard. And I'm sure I had like a little sugar here and there, but I really started to look at things like, oh, wow, there's sugar in my ketchup, you know, there's sugar in everything. And so I cut it out and it was hard as well. And then I felt better. And then I started to really, you know, maintain that stomach health with probiotics and eating right, eating lots of vegetables and things like that. And today I can eat, you know, I can eat cake and not feel bloated and nasty. I could eat 2 pieces of cake and not feel bloated and nasty. Nice. You know, so I think it's about finding that balance for you. If you still have poor gut health, it's really important to look at your relationship with sugar. Mm-hmm. If you're starting to feel better, you can have some in moderation and you just got to keep an eye on it. And right now I just feel like I'm in maintain mode. I feel like I'm in such a healthy place in my life that I'm just maintaining that health and I'll still eat a piece of cake.
Yeah, no, of course. And it's great to have that balance. And I think even, you know, some fitness experts, for example, the ones that do super well that I see are the ones that say it's okay to have a couple drinks. It's okay to have a couple cheat meals, as opposed to the ones that are, you know, completely, you know, rigorous, very strict diet. And it's also very unattainable for the average person. They can't really go about their lives like a Navy SEAL. It's not realistic for everyone. But what does maintain mode look? I guess I have two questions for you. One of them is, what does maintain mode look like for you? And the second one would be, obviously, people, you know, celiac listeners, for example, we have a decent sized celiac audience. In fact, it's probably our biggest cohort among, you know, the diets that we support. What is something that celiacs, obviously, they know don't have gluten, but what is something else that's maybe like a secret hack that maybe they're not aware of that they could do to help improve their health? So that's the second question. The first question is, what is your maintain mode look like?
Oh, my maintain mode. Well, I like what you're saying, that like it's unrealistic to like cut everything out of your life except an apple, right? Like we have to be able to eat a variety of foods, and we have to be able to eat out and enjoy life and all of those things that come with it. And I think it's a mindset right now. This is not a diet, even though we say gluten-free diet, it's a medically necessary treatment, right? And so cutting out gluten isn't like this fad diet that most people fail at. It's a lifelong change that you're sort of forced to make, and you stick with it because your life sort of depends on it, right? And so maintaining it is really being strict about being gluten-free. And I think there are a lot of people who do what I call cheat on their gluten-free diet. They're like, oh, it's my birthday, I'm going to eat that, right? Yeah. Just every so often. They usually feel the repercussions of eating that pretty quickly. Yeah. Or there's people who don't, you know, take cross-contamination seriously. And I think we see that more with the gluten-sensitive community, not to single them out, but because they don't have that firm diagnosis that is taken seriously by the medical community, they might feel like they can eat gluten. And that's not a shot at them. It's just that we need more research to legitimize this disorder, because it's very real. I see a lot of people suffering with gluten sensitivity, sometimes even more than those of us with celiac.
So you're saying gluten sensitivity is still not fully defined yet.
Right.
But they are defined as not being celiac. That much we know.
Yes. It's called non-celiac gluten sensitivity, NCGS. I think I got that right. And it is a real disorder, but there isn't a lot of research on it. There isn't a lot of widely accepted ways to necessarily diagnose it. Right. There's some tests out there, but there's just not this wide acceptance in the medical community. But I always say, just because there's a lack of research and information does not mean there is a lack of disorder. Right. It's definitely a real disorder for people.
Well, sometimes I find that, like I was in Italy and I could eat, I'm not supposed to eat dairy. I haven't been diagnosed as lactose intolerant. I don't have a dairy allergy. And I typically stay away from dairy because it does tend to trigger a flare up. However, when I was on vacation in Italy, and how can you not be eating dairy in Italy?
Pizza.
How can you not? And by the way, they have a very good understanding of celiac in Italy. That's a different thing. But I had no issues at all the entire time I was there. And to me, that's a little bit weird, because I think if you're lactose intolerant, it doesn't take a day off. And so that might also, I don't know if it's obviously not the same thing one for one, but it is another phenomenon where sometimes things are very triggering for you and sometimes they're not. Maybe that has to do with what you were saying earlier about, you know, the microbiome situation, in your gut at any given time. Perhaps you're in a better situation in one period and other times you're not. So it's going to get you. Sometimes there's a perfect storm brewing and it's waiting for one trigger. It's waiting for that lighter to go off to put the whole thing aflame, and other times it's not. Do you think that that rings similarly to gluten sensitivity, or are they repeatedly every single time being glutened based on your experience?
Right. Well, we know there's no one size fits all approach to any of this right now. Like everybody is different. What I What I have learned from some of my research in gluten sensitivity, far from an expert here, and there is an amazing expert that I'm happy to tell you about, but gluten actually causes inflammation in all humans. There's been a study. It was a study done by a team of researchers, and one of the researchers was the leading celiac doctor in the world, the most well-known, Dr. Alessio Fasano. And they found that gluten actually causes an inflammatory response in everyone who eats it, right? So all humans get that. Some of us can deal with the inflammation and go back to normal and we feel fine. Some of us who maybe have a weak link in our digestive system or wherever that weak link is in our body, that repeated assault will just eventually break down. And that's where you see a lot of people have reactions to gluten, and they're not just those classical GI symptoms like stomach aches and diarrhea and things like that. You're actually seeing people with osteoporosis or all sorts of skin rashes and conditions. You're seeing all sorts of thyroid issues. It's kind of wild how celiac is presenting itself in so many different ways. And it's just so different for everybody. Everyone has a different reaction to gluten if they have an issue with it, right? So I forgot your question, but I was just dogging
that was
there.
That was a very good interlude there with I like the what you said, because I mean, to me, that's not evident for the average person that gluten causes inflammation, period. I think people don't really know that, and to me, I think I did hear about that once, but I'm like, no, it's okay. That gets me thinking, well, perhaps there might be, you know, maybe a future looks like we have food without gluten in it, and that becomes the norm. We don't really know with all these autoimmune conditions that, you know, they cause a ton of inflammation, and then you need to basically take a bunch of steroids to bring your inflammation down. We don't really, I think everyone unanimously agrees, inflammation ain't great. And so if this is a fact, you know, that's something for everyone to be aware of. There's a company, I don't know if you heard of them, I think they're out of Israel, and they are looking to extract gluten from food. So instead of making gluten-free food, they're making regular food just without the gluten, I guess, right, molecules or something. Did you hear about this?
I've heard about that. And I think there's all sorts of technology like that CRISPR technology where gene editing gluten out of things. And, you know, you can even, a lot of gluten-free products contain wheat starch, and it's just the starch of the wheat. They take the gluten protein out. And so I think we are hitting this gluten at both ends. Like we're trying to maybe create gluten that, or wheat that is gluten-free and by editing genes or all these different technologies out there. I don't even know them all. Right. And then we're also looking for ways to just maybe treat celiac disease or cure celiac disease. So I think there's a lot of different research options. It'll be interesting which way the world goes. But I think you're right. If we're seeing gluten isn't just a problem for the, you know, several million people who have celiac disease. There's like 18 million people in the US who have gluten sensitivity, and this is rising. These are rising, and I can see the tide rising. And I think if more and more people are having issues with gluten, we're going to have to really assess what is in our food. And who knows, maybe everyone will be eating low gluten or no gluten diets in the future.
I think it does, you know, chronologically, if you were to look at this, and even, you know, if we just put ourselves 100 years in the future, I think, and we look back, I think we might call this period of time, you know, the enlightenment of food and the dietary factors, because this definitely wasn't the case, you know, 50 years ago. But who knows how many people were suffering still 50 years ago and attributing it to so many other things. Right. So this is a very, very cool time to be alive in terms of the innovation that's happening to help solve this problem. Because of all of our celiac listeners, I did want to go back to this question. What is something that they can do to help themselves feel good, whether something preventative or after the fact? What is some little hack that they could implement in their life and in their own maintenance modes that might be useful, whether that's, you know, I don't know, getting more sleep or drinking this thing or eating that thing, or what, do you have a hack like that? Does that exist? That's universal?
Oh, There's so many. I talk about many of them. Well, I'm going to think of one that I want to bring up. Something that I promote a lot, and that I don't do right now, but I do intermittently, is that I juice. And I mean, like, real, I make my own cold pressed vegetable juices with a little bit of fruit just for a little sweetness, and like a, you know, real thick green juice, not blended in the blender, but like in the juicer.
Yeah.
And I would drink that in lieu of meals or snacks. And it was a way that I rested my digestive system. And I talk a lot about resting your digestive system, because again, it's broken, right?
Uh-huh.
If you have celiac disease, your small intestine needs time to heal.
Yeah.
And you got to give it a chance to heal. Our body's incredible. It heals. You know, you get a cut on your finger, what, the next day you barely see it, right? Like, it heals. It knows how to heal if you stop assaulting it day after day.
Uh-huh.
And so juicing was a really great way for me to rest my digestive system, just flood my body with all those micronutrients and feel good. And so I highly recommend looking at different strategies for resting and restoring your digestive system, and really treating it like you would treat a broken bone in your body.
Got it. I mean, that's a huge point in terms of resting the digestive system. Is that something that you'd recommend for people who, let's say, they've just been glutened, and then you could do that after you've been glutened, for example, to help expedite the recovery process?
Possibly. I mean, I think that if you are sensitive to gluten, like you were mentioning, like, you feel a reaction right away. I feel a reaction probably within an hour. Mm. I feel that, you know, stomach bubbling up and, you know, that urgency. I think that if you really have healed your body and you have taken the time to heal and restore your small intestine, which is damaged in people with celiac disease, you're going to be able to fight off those small gluten exposures a little bit more easily, and you're going to be able to recover a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you're not healed and you're not in good shape, you're going to probably suffer a little bit more of that gluten exposure. I do tell a lot of people that before they eat out, like, if they're worried about small gluten exposures, that they could take a digestive enzyme. There's a lot of digestive enzymes that target the protein gluten and help break it down. It probably won't quell all your symptoms, but if you accidentally get a teeny bit of gluten in your body because you ate out or at a friend's house, it's just another line of defense to help you feel better more quickly and recover from any sort of accidental glutening.
Excellent. Okay, that's a very good hack then for people to be aware of.
Yeah, I have some here. I just bought these. I was going to try this brand, Glutenese.
Glutenese.
It's not a substitute for eating gluten. Like, I can't go eat a whole loaf of bread and probably die. But if I eat out, just pop one in and then have my meal. And it's sort of like an insurance policy,
uh-huh,
just in case. And it helps break down gluten. Now, our body naturally makes these digestive enzymes.
Right, of course.
And we actually, now our whole digestive tract is making protease, which is the digestive enzyme that would help break down protein, which is gluten. Gluten is a protein. And so our body's making all sorts of digestive enzymes. So I tell people, don't take them, don't overtake them, because you don't want to train your body to not produce them, you know, if it thinks it's already making enough.
Right.
You want to train your body to make these digestive enzymes. But like I said, if you eat out, you're a little nervous, just a little bit of exposure on accident, cross-contamination, you just take one, and hopefully it helps with those symptoms. I know a lot of people it helps. Some it doesn't, but a lot of people it does help.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a very good, I mean, not even a hack, but just a very good strategy to keep that with you. And if you are looking, you say, well, I'm not 100% sure, here's an insurance policy for me, take that. And just in case, I could feel a little bit better, at least. That sounds really good. What are your thoughts on intermittent fasting in terms of helping the gut recover?
Yeah, I think that's another really great strategy for resting that digestive system that we talk about. And so I, like I said, this is not a diet. This is not a fad thing to me. this is my life.
Yeah.
And so I don't do that, you know, 24 hours of not eating kind of things. Like, yeah. I don't know that that's sustainable well into my golden years, right? Like, yeah. I want something that I can just live with day to day. But intermittent fasting is a good tool, especially if you still haven't fully recovered or healed your body. And I tell people who ask me, what I do is I stop eating at 7 o'clock. I eat my dinner, kitchen's closed. And then I don't eat again until 7 o'clock after I wake up, I walk my dog, I get ready, I eat my breakfast. And so that's a good 12-hour window. And yeah. What I think a lot of people don't realize is when you are resting, that is when you're sleeping, that is when your digestive system's working, because it doesn't work necessarily all day long in the same way it's really working at night, because everything else is sort of shut down in your body. And so that's when you're sleeping, that's your rest and digest phase. That's the time where you are doing your most digesting. And so give it a chance. And then I also talk about not necessarily fasting, but just don't eat all day. Like, it's so easy to just like snack all day, but that's not giving your stomach time to process the food between meals. And so really be mindful of some of those things, especially in the healing process. And so, you know, eat 3 meals a day, have one snack and have a healthy snack, you know, yeah. Really focus on those good habits, because that's sort of how we're programmed as humans to function optimally. And and so I really do allow my body that overnight time to rest. That's why sleep is so restorative, not just to stress in your brain, but it's so restorative to your stomach. It's the time when you're digesting. That's why many people wake up and need to have a bowel movement, all these things. Your stomach worked all night to process what you put in over throughout the day, right? So
yeah. And it's something that, definitely. People forget about that sometimes, that there are other elements to it. And that's why, again, I always turn back to the holistic nutrition experts because of that word. I mean, holistic is there for a reason, that as much as you want to focus on the diet, it's not necessarily a cure-all for everything, right? If you're sleeping, if you're stressed out and you're sleeping 5 hours a night and you're working some crazy job or whatever, you're not putting yourself in a position to succeed for anything, really. I mean, there's so many reasons to get better sleep, and there usually isn't really an excuse not to, unless maybe you have like a newborn and you have to go through that process. But beyond that,
I'm done with that.
Yeah, you're done with that? Yeah, I'm not there yet, so I don't know, but definitely, you know.
Good luck.
Thank you. Yeah, I need to gear up for that, make sure I'm healthy when that happens. And as far as exercise, I do something. I like to share this story because I think it's kind of stupid. The doctor thought it was kind of stupid, but maybe it's legit. I don't know. When I was trying to get into remission, I was doing everything to try to get into remission because the doctor wanted to put me on like the higher medication. I'm like, no, keep me on the low medication. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go to the gym, and at the gym, I'm going to work on my abs, because if I work on my abs, that's going to send blood to the colon area of my body, and maybe something magical is going to happen with the blood circulation in that part of my body. And I told it after to the GI doc. He's like, that probably didn't do anything. But who knows?
Right. As you said, I've never heard that before. You know what, though? If it works for you, keep doing it, right? I was going to say, like, a lot of people work these stressful jobs and they live these really stressful lives, and then they do these stressful workouts.
Yeah.
And that is doing more harm than good. It's just placing more and more stress on the body. So something with working out that I like to tell people is, if you live a stressful life, that's unavoidable. You know, there's so many people have certain jobs, maybe doctors, you know, things that are just really stressful. You know, do more yoga, more relaxing sort of exercises. Right. It's a way to calm your body. And I think you will lose more weight. You'll burn more fat. But if you have a real calm life and a calm desk job, you know, your body's probably going to need more of that cardio and things like that. So, but I think for your story, which is really funny, I don't know that that necessarily works, but I think we just feel what works for us. And yeah. I always tell people, go for it. If it's working for you, do it, right?
Right. Well, everything that you say, a lot of what you say, even on your Instagram posts and everything, is to do with the mindset. And if it gets you in a good mindset, I mean, if you need to go hit a punching bag and that's going to put you in the right mindset, right. then do that. Is there anything else before we wrap up that you want to share, or anything you want to share before we wrap up?
Oh my gosh. Well, I don't know.
You don't have so to.
I mean, yeah. I'm happy
you
to
did
share.
Well.
Like, right. Thank you. Thank you. There's so much to share. And yeah. I really do love the community that we have here with the celiac and the gluten-free community. It's a really great community. And I hope people will come join me over at goodforyouglutenfree.com. You know, join my newsletter. I do all sorts of fun things. I do, testing food for hidden gluten, and I share the results of that. I share all sorts of recipes and meal plans and things like that. And so we have just a really great community. And like you said, we also have, sharing those kind of mindset tips or, situations yeah. we've all been in, and we just share that information with each other. So I feel like my celiac and gluten-free community is my second family in many ways.
Yeah, that's right. And I think even from yesterday, you posted about a babka, gluten-free babka, which looks amazing. So definitely yes. people should check that out. They can find more about you, Jenny, at goodforyouglutenfree.com, where, as Jenny was saying, there's so many things to check out. You have her book, recipes, meal plans, obviously all the blog posts, a celiac disease library, which is very cool, tons of resources. You do still have consulting here. You have a shop here and many other little eBooks and a lot of hidden gems on this website. It's jam packed with information. If you have celiac and you don't know about this resource, you are most definitely missing out. So please go check it out, and give her a follow as well for some Instagram motivation and entertainment and knowledge. But Jenny, it was a pleasure having you on the Across the Dietary Universe podcast. We really appreciate your time, all the truth bombs that you dropped today, and all the cool gems that you were able to share with us. It's going to help a lot of people, and we love your mission and what you're all about.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on and helping spread the word about living healthy and gluten-free. So thank you.
Cool. Thank you.